Hi, I'm here with Jonathan Rausch. Thanks for joining me again.
Happy to be here.
So let's jump right into it. You have recently written yet another important article for The Atlantic where you can often be found. The title of this one is Yes, It's Fascism. So that got my attention. I'm sure it got other people's attention. Like you, I've resisted using this term because there were obvious historical associations that didn't quite and don't quite map onto our current circumstance under Trump 2.0. But the resistance has seemed more and more pedantic as the months have rolled by and the overreach and indecency of this administration has become more and more obvious and unignorable and odious. Well, let's just start with your misgivings about it, which you expressed to some degree in the article, and yet you've overcome them. How did you decide to finally pull the trigger on this terminology, and what are your concerns about doing so?
Well, it was painful, I'll tell you that. This was the article I had hoped never to write. A year ago in The Atlantic, I wrote an article saying that Trump was not a fascist, he's a patrimonialist. And that's a style of government that you find not only in states, but in the mafia, criminal organizations, cults, political machines, where the state is in effect the personal property and family business of the leader. Mm. And in that situation, the head of state will go rampage through the bureaucracy, cutting through rules and replacing people with personal loyalists. And then things get very corrupt and they get very incompetent. And that's clearly what we were seeing. And that, I think, uncontroversially applied to Trump. But patrimonialism, it's not ideological. It's not especially aggressive. It's not interested in the use of force or taking over other countries, for example. And it could have just been about Trump and enrichment. And I thought initially that's probably where things were headed. But over the course of the last year, and specifically over the course of the past few weeks and couple of months, we saw the emergence of so many properties that are associated with fascism that to me, it became perverse to withhold the label. So I finally dropped my resistance, sat down, thought of all the things I could think of that are usually associated with fascism. There's no standard definition or bright line in out kind of status. And I had no trouble coming up with 18 of them. And at that point, I threw in the towel and I said, we got to name this thing.
Mm. So yeah, I want to walk through those 18 or many of them as you present them in the article. But let's just linger on patrimonialism because it's certainly bad enough, right? This has taken us to a place, you know, if he were merely a patrimonialist, he's taken us to a place that we don't want to be, or at least shouldn't want to be, despite the fact that half the country still seems to be cheering. So when you talk about patrimonialism as an approach to governance, in this case, where the state and where America, let's not speak so generically, America and her policies, her institutions, you know, everything is considered effectively Trump's personal property to be sold off for personal advantage. I mean, we've seen him do that with the tariff policy. You know, he slaps a 46% tariff on Vietnam. And how does Vietnam try to get that tariff removed? They greenlight a $1.5 billion resort deal for the Trump family. There are now scores of examples like this. And the Trump family has enriched itself to the tune of at least $1, $2, or $3 billion, depending on which account you favor. But there's probably more than that that's happened. I mean, this is all just absolutely despicable and destructive of our standing in the world. And yet, this was a stop on the train before we reached fascism. I just wanted to emphasize that, you know, whether or not someone agrees that you're naming this correctly, we shouldn't lose sight of, you know, all the ground our country has lost and is losing under this president.
Yes, it was more than bad enough when it was patrimonialism. We've never seen the U.S. government turned into the personal property of the leader where, you know, he dials up a prosecution or he accepts gold bars and then bases his tariffs, you know, based on stuff that people give him. And that's the opposite under patrimonialism. The opposite of patrimonialism is not democracy, it's bureaucracy. Because what they want to do is weaken all the tendons in the bureaucracies that make government competent, because you don't want experts. Experts are loyal to ideals and professional standards. You want people who are loyal only to you. So you wind up with appointments like, I don't know, think of your incompetent Trump appointee, or think about how they fired all those people who watch over nuclear weapons only to have to hire them back. So you destroy the government's competence with patrimonialism. What you don't do is reorient the direction of the government in a way that's ideological or aggressive or organized. And that, I think, was, as you say, the next stop on the line.
So there's a difference, and you acknowledge this difference in your piece, between having a leader and his enablers who are fascists or aspiring fascists or fascistic to whatever degree, and having the full capture of government and society by a regime that is in fact fascist. And you wouldn't say we have succumbed in that final sense, nor do I think you think we're likely to succumb. And so this is not going to look like Hitler's Germany, even in the worst case scenario. So to be clear, what you seem to think now is that calling Trump and his enablers, and many of whom are far more ideological than he shows any sign of being, calling them fascist is more or less unavoidable at this point.
It seems more or less unavoidable. I'd actually like to get your take on whether it's advisable, because there is a school of thought that says, look, it does no good to use this word. It's just a generalized slur, and it will get people's back up without accomplishing anything. I felt that part of what Trump is so good at, I think you've actually mentioned this often on your show, Sam, is throwing up so many distractions and outrages on any given day that our minds can't stay tuned on the big picture of what it is he's doing, and that people need these labels. They need these boxes to put things in order to be able to keep their eye on the bigger picture, and that fascism is now the appropriate box, and in fact, maybe the only appropriate box. So that's why I thought this was important. Others may think it's premature. I don't know.
Well, so I pulled up a definition of fascism. As you point out, this is a term that is pretty loosely defined, and you can, it has blurry borders. There's no question. But here's one definition. I went to ChatGPT for this. Fascism is an ultranationalist, anti-liberal political project organized around a promise of a national rebirth, a cleansing restoration after a story of humiliation and decay. It rejects pluralism as a sham, treats opposition as an enemy rather than as a rival, and elevates coercion, often outright violence, as morally necessary to purge internal, quote, traitors and reassert collective greatness. In its mature form, it becomes a leader-centered mass movement that fuses with the state, corrodes neutral institutions, and renders genuine political competition functionally impossible. So all of that resonates with the current moment. I mean, the only piece that has not been achieved, but I don't think it will be for want of trying, is this final line of, it renders genuine political competition functionally impossible, right? So it'll be very important what happens in November around the midterm elections. One could argue that not all of these variables have been fully achieved, but there's certainly been movement directionally across all of these domains. And so you put this in slightly different language in your piece. So let's just kind of run through your 18. We might not get to all of them, and let me know if you want to skip ahead to any that you more favor. But let's just start with the first one, demolition of norms. What do you mean by that?
The first thing I should say, if I can have a word of preface, is that there is no bright line settled definition of fascism.
Yeah.
Even fascists don't agree on what fascism is. And in different countries over many years, it's taken different forms. Japan looked very different from Franco, who looked different from Mussolini, who looked different from Hitler. So my method here was to assemble characteristics that most people would agree are, first of all, consonant with fascism, and second of all, dissonant with, incompatible with liberal pluralism. And I think everything on this list fits that bill, and everything on this list fits Trump and the direction he's trying to take the country.
Yeah.
It does not fit the country as a whole. We'll come back to that. But we don't live in a fascist state. We live in a mixed state, hybrid state, with a liberal constitution and a fascist leader. That gets complicated. Okay. So what are the things we're talking about? About half the items on this list, more or less, are things that are new since his first term, or things that have gotten so much worse that we have to recontextualize them. Others are old. But now looking back, we can say that they fit into fascism, and the demolition of norms is one of these. You know, he starts his campaign in 2016, 15, I guess, with trolling, with extreme insults, with making comments about a news anchor's, apparently her period, with insulting John McCain and saying he's not a war hero. Insult after insult. And we think this is just because he's some kind of crazy person or he's mentally unbalanced. But this is what you do if you're a fascist and you want to dominate the dialogue, because liberals, people like me, people like you, who are kind of trained to be civil and tolerant, we can't function in that space. We just become dumbfounded in that space. We don't compete there. And fascists know that. And it's why something Hitler says in Mein Kampf is, it doesn't matter if they laugh at us or ridicule us. All that matters is that they can't stop thinking about us. And that's what they're doing in the context of fascism.
Yeah, it's interesting. And recalling Hitler in this context is relevant. It has been the case historically that fascist figures present, certainly before they achieve their aims, they present as comical figures. I mean, they present as clowns. They present as easy targets of ridicule, right? So the cultural machinery of satire gets working against them, but in these cases where they succeed, the satire proves ineffectual, right? So if you look back in the late 20s and early 30s in Germany, Hitler was very often portrayed as a buffoon, as somebody who was not going to achieve his aims, quite obviously, because he was so comical and tawdry and norm-breaking. And that was clearly has been our attitude toward Trump all the while. I mean, it's on some level, it still is, because I do think he lacks some of the things that proper demagogues like Hitler had. But the fact that he's so entertaining and so seemingly harmless because he's just a colossal jackass on some basic level causes many people I think many people hearing this conversation will feel that we are at every point exaggerating the danger, exaggerating the harms already committed, because when you take a look at this guy and what he and the things he says, there's something deeply unserious about him as a person. I mean, this is why we have, you know, his defenders, effectively, I mean, the main defense of him for now going on nearly a decade is, or has been, you know, take him seriously, but not literally. I mean, this is the first time in my lifetime where I've noticed people, serious people, seemingly serious people, telling everyone in sight not to care what the president of the United States says he's going to do, as though that could ever make sense. And yet that's been the attitude. It's just like, he doesn't mean it. You know, he's not going to take Greenland. Oh, he and his director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, just accused the previous president, President Obama, of treason, which is a killing offense in most cases. That's not serious. You don't have to listen to any of that. He's just playing around, right? And so there's something about the lack of seriousness that is the style of presentation here that is, it's a pattern. It's not just Trump.
Well, it's a historical pattern. You're correct. Hitler was seen as a buffoon in the 1920s. Mussolini was seen as this kind of strutting popinjay. Actually, even Hitler wound up thinking of Mussolini as something of a buffoon, but Mussolini was not a buffoon. In fact, mm-hmm. He was a brilliant guy. He was a former journalist. He had been a socialist before he became a fascist. No coincidence there. These are smart people, and they are intentionally and deliberately manipulating the public discourse and dialogue, first to hijack people's minds so that you think about them all the time. Second, to move the ground of public discourse to an arena where liberal Democrats, you know, small d, cannot compete. And third, to show that they're in control of what can and cannot be said. All the stuff your mom taught you about what you can and can't say, throw it out the window. They're in the driver's seat now, and that's the message you get.
So the second point you raised, the glorification of violence. Now, this, I think, has not been pushed nearly as far as most people think it must be pushed to justify any kind of analogy to what they consider fascism. And this is one place where I even wonder whether Trump is the sort of person who's capable of this. I mean, you think of, you know, the Night of Long Knives, yeah, that's finally secured Hitler's power, right? So this is the night where Hitler, having become chancellor, decides, all right, the SA has too much power, is not totally aligned with the SS and the army. I need to keep the conservatives on board. And so what we're going to do in the next 24 hours is murder, you know, the top 200 people or the 100 to 200 people in this organization who have been my loyalists all the while. So what people think about here when you mention violence is the propensity to actually start rounding up people and killing them, right? So now that's, I must admit that I, you know, as sinister as some of these guys seem to me, people like Stephen Miller and J.D. Vance, you know, who seem far more ideological and on that level dangerous than Trump himself, it is hard for me to imagine the murders, right? So tell me what you're referencing here and how far your imagination ranges.
Well, remember, this list is not about describing America as being right now in the end state of fascism. It's not. I don't think it will be. In fact, I'm slightly more optimistic on that score than I was a few months ago. Mm. I'm instead looking at the characteristics of the rhetoric and the leadership. So one of the hallmarks of liberal democracy, of course, every government has to use violence. But it's important whether they do that reluctantly and as a last resort, and whether they will try to de-conflict a situation, talk it down, minimize the use of violence, or whether their rhetoric and their actions are suggesting, no, this can be a first resort. You can be standing on a street corner and holding up your phone as a peaceful protester in Minneapolis, and then hurled to the ground, be swarmed by federal agents, and then be shot multiple times. And the government's reaction to that will be that you were some kind of, what did they say about Mr. Preti?
A terrorist, an insurrectionist bent upon massacre. Yeah.
And when you see that, and when you see people being dragged out of cars, and when you see the kind of rhetoric that Pete Hegseth has been using, there's an article about that, I think, in The Atlantic, I think just today. When you see memes that are displaying violence in hortatory terms, you know, people rappelling from helicopters to assault apartment buildings in the United States, when you see sharing on government platforms of a children's comic book character with a machine gun, shooting up boats, killing all the people in them, and glorying in that, reveling in that, saying, isn't that great? That's incompatible with the kind of society that our founders were trying to build.
Yeah, yeah. I did a section of a podcast on this already, but I remain astonished that the Second Amendment devotees in our country, the many millions of them for whom, you know, the right to bear arms is the central plank of their civic religion, that they've been so acquiescent and really just so blind to the implications of the Preti killing, because what happened in the immediate aftermath of that killing, which we saw from at least three different sides, and you can see he never reached for his gun, and his murder was totally gratuitous. It was a pure repudiation of the Second Amendment, and everyone from the president and the vice president on down to Kash Patel and Kristi Noem and everyone who got in front of a microphone in the aftermath of that spoke to the country as though the Second Amendment doesn't exist, right? I mean, they basically said in so many words, and more or less all of them said this, that if you are in possession of a firearm anywhere near federal law enforcement, that is very likely a death sentence. You know, don't do that. And that's not what something like, I would say at least 10 million Americans have been saying is the most important thing in our country for as long as I've been alive. I mean, we've had millions of Americans over there on the right who have been buying guns, training with guns, cleaning their guns, talking about guns, coveting their neighbor's gun. It's all been about guns, and it hasn't been about guns for home defense. It's been about guns because at some point in the future, we could have a tyrannical government that will begin to infringe upon our civil liberties, the most important of which is our ability to defend those civil liberties by recourse to the Second Amendment. And here we had a guy who was practicing his First Amendment rights to assemble and speak freely against the behavior of ICE, and he was forced to the ground, disarmed, and then killed. And then you had the director of the FBI, among others, get on television and speak as though the Second Amendment doesn't even exist. Where the hell are the conservative gun owners on this?
Well, I am certainly the wrong person to address that question. I grew up in Arizona, which was a strong NRA state, and hearing about, you'll get my gun away from me when you pry it from my cold, dead fingers. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is when the jackbooted thugs come, you need to be able to fight back. I guess I would just say that in my now 65 years of adult existence, I have given up on expecting consistency and anything but hypocrisy from partisans, especially extreme ones. So that's why in this article, I chose to focus instead on the larger phenomenon that they're excusing, which is, I think, a previously maybe not unthinkable use of state violence, but unapologetic use of state violence.
So a related concept here, might is right.
So this is one of the things that changed in the last few months that pushed me over the line. We had seen in the first term, we saw some of the transactionalism in foreign policy that Trump's hallmark, and we've seen some of the strange behavior toward Russia, you know, the deferential treatment of Putin. In the second term, we've seen the emergence, first implicit in the Oval Office meeting with Zelensky, you know, which was all about, you're weak, you don't have cards, you must cede ground to the stronger party. And then becoming explicit really got my attention when Stephen Miller said, just I think earlier this year, I'll quote this, "We live in a world that is governed by strength, by power. Those are the iron laws of this world that have existed since the beginning of time." Those words could have come from the mouth of any 1930s fascist dictator. That's the idea that the strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must. It is a distinctive character of authoritarianism generally and fascism specifically. It is completely inconsistent with the American tradition going back to the founders. And that was one of the things that said, Sam, I can't help it. I see an ideological direction emerging here.
Yeah. What do you do with the fact that the ideology comes pouring out of the mouths of people like Stephen Miller and J.D. Vance, and I guess people like Russell Vogt? I don't really hear him speak much, but you know, he's working behind the scenes. And it's not so much a matter of what the president says. I mean, he's obviously capable of contradicting himself. If he says something that is in this direction, he can say something that seems to erase the thing he said 5 minutes ago. How do you just do the political math on the contributions of the people around him to the direction of our government versus what the president himself seems to be doing?
You know, trying to penetrate the coils of Donald Trump's mind is such a losing game. I don't know what goes through that skull of his, but part of this recent discovery for me is that he has promoted and enabled and is actively supporting people who clearly do believe in these ancient pre-liberal concepts of power as self-justifying and the real rule of law in the world being the rule of the strong. And he has not repudiated that point of view. Mussolini was explicitly hostile to international organizations because he said they interfered with the power of the nationalist state to exert its will on the world stage. And that seems to be where Trump is coming from implicitly, but when Stephen Miller said it, you can't hear those words and unhear them.
Yeah, I mean, for the longest time, Miller himself has just presented as a fascist straight out of central casting. I mean, the fact that he's Jewish just adds a weird dystopian flourish to this moment. It's like, let's figure out how to make this even more confusing and awful. Let's make him the uber fascist, also Jewish, and make it, you know, even harder to diagnose the nature of the problem. But yeah, I mean, he's just been, you know, every inch of him has been fascistic for as long as he's had a voice.
Well, you know, personalities aren't my game. And again, I don't want to know what's going on in his head. I wonder if some of these people even have the basic historical literacy to understand what it is, the significance of what they're saying.
Politicized law enforcement.
Yeah, this is a big one. This is a really big one for me. I tell people, you know, it's so much going on, it's hard to sort through. And I tell people, that if I had to name the single most dangerous thing to our democracy, our rule of law that's going on under Trump, it's the explicit, underline explicit, politicization of law enforcement. No bones about it. The president issues executive orders demanding the criminal investigation slash prosecution of political enemies. He did that some months ago. Then more recently, he breaks the law, according to a judge, in order to order and serve up the prosecution of James Comey and Letitia James. He simply says, prosecute these people. They have to fire an unwilling career prosecutor in order to do it and put in a prosecutor illegally, who then throws the case out. But the big issue here isn't the fine points of the law. It's that, to my knowledge, never before in American history, not even under Nixon, who certainly played games with the IRS and the Justice Department, not even under Nixon did it become explicit that we live in a dual state. Now, I think you've referenced that concept. A lot of people have. One of the things that we know about authoritarianism generally and fascism specifically is it does two things simultaneously. It'll have a normal state with courts of law. So if you have to sue your neighbor, or you know, you're tried for burglary or ordinary crimes, the justice system looks normal. But at any moment, you can be yanked out of that justice system into an abnormal system that is accountable directly to the rulers, a system of kangaroo courts in which you can be dispatched however the government wants you to be. That's what happened to Alex Priddy. He thinks he's in a normal state where he's within his rights to stand holding a cell phone and nonviolently confront federal officers, only to find 15 seconds later, he's in a very different state, one in which the state exercises the power as it will. That's the situation that James Comey and Letitia James and others have found themselves in. It's the state now that Don Lemon has found himself in, suddenly charged with the crime for covering the news, and so forth. All by itself, I think, you tell me if you think this isn't an overstatement, but all by itself, the flagrant politicization of the justice system gets us halfway down the road to a country like Hungary.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the most shocking things that happened at the very beginning of the second term was the way he managed to go after the preeminent law firms in the country and how many of them just acquiesced to the pressure. I mean, some fought back, but some just, I mean, some gave him something like $1 billion in pro bono work for his pet causes.
Yeah, I didn't know they had $1 billion.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, there's $1 billion of their forward-looking time, apparently. But I mean, if the lawyers aren't going to fight when the administration comes for them, I mean, who stands a chance of successfully fighting? You know, and much of this doesn't really show up in the news. I mean, when you imagine the details for any person who becomes the object of a gratuitous, politicized investigation, right? So, I mean, you know, what's happening to Don Lemon or what's happening to James Comey? I mean, in some cases, maybe it just bounces off the justice system because it's so obviously unwarranted and the judge throws it out and it doesn't take up much of the person's life. But in some of these cases, you can well imagine people are getting bankrupted or nearly bankrupted trying to defend themselves, and it's taking a lot of time. You know, it's a ton of money and a lot of time.
And you'll think twice before confronting the government. And the investigation is the punishment. And that's the point that they're making. I mentioned that in some ways I'm feeling better about things than I was a few months ago, even though I'm feeling worse about the administration. We are seeing, maybe we should come to this later and not now, you tell me, but we are seeing people figure it out and understanding that those who capitulated early on got little or nothing in return and often just invited the administration to come back for more.
Right.
And the Europeans seem to now have figured that out, and that's going to make it harder for them to function in this way. But it's not going to stop them from trying.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that has been one of the most depressing aspects of this. And again, this is a pattern that one sees in every historical context where these, where democracies have unraveled in this sort of way. It's been the complicity, the seemingly needless complicity of the richest, most powerful people in our society. I mean, they just, you know, to use Timothy Snyder's phrase from his book on tyranny, they just obeyed in advance, right? I mean, they just immediately got into line. They just stumbled over themselves racing to fund the inauguration and showed up with gifts. I mean, these were precisely the people. I mean, now I'm talking about people who are running public or private companies who personally have, in really every case, tens of billions of dollars, in some cases, hundreds of billions of dollars, again, personally, who could have easily resisted this, right? I mean, you think of the most famous, you know, the top 10 richest people in this country, all of them could have said, listen, this orange imposter is not going to ruin the business environment in America. It would be suicidal for him to do it. If he comes after our companies, we've got as many lawyers as the state has. He can go fuck himself, right? You know, this is why I have all this money in the first place, to be able to say this right now when American democracy is at stake. Not one of them did that.
Well, let's pat Harvard on the back. It's not a corporation, business leader, but it stood up and won. And then UCLA stood up and won. And then some of the law firms, to their credit, stood up and won, got sound court decisions. And we haven't seen the administration go after law firms recently.
But where were the billionaires? Like, how do you explain to yourself why some of these guys, and all I can think of are guys at the moment, none of them, I mean, there are obviously billionaires who worked very hard to get Kamala Harris elected and failed and now are keeping their heads down. But where were the billionaires? I mean, you know that, you know, I mean, insofar as I know any of these guys personally, I know that not one of them respected Trump before he became president. This is not a situation where we're talking about people who really were on Trump's side of this thing from day one. No, these were people who looked on in horror, quite reminiscent of the horror you and I are expressing in this conversation at the turn that American democracy was taking. And yet now there's, you know, we got Tim Cook showing up with solid gold Apple merch, et cetera.
I do not want to sound like I'm apologizing for these guys or excusing them, but I think you know the answer to that because I've heard that on your show as well, or some of the answers. One is the collective action problem. You're hoping that the eye of Sauron will pass over you and onto the next guy, and that you can hold him off for the duration, and that may or may not be right. So there's that. Second, one of the reasons that I decided to call it fascism and name it and suffer whatever, you know, blowback or incredulity might result from that is I don't think especially early on people understood what they were dealing with. You know, okay, he's a quirky guy. He's very transactional. I can bribe him with gewgaws, so we can live with that. I think it's important to show them how perverse it is that I think I could stand this up. I haven't done the research, Sam, but you tell me if I think this is wrong. Corporate America showed a whole lot more overt hostility to Barack Obama when he was president than they ever have to Donald Trump, who is someone who is nationalizing taking portions, golden shares, and 10 percentage points of revenues for certain sales of private companies, something that Barack Obama never dreamed of doing.
Can you imagine? I mean, again, it's just the great party game to just imagine Obama doing any one of 1,000 things Trump has done, and I'm just imagining the response. But yeah, no, when Obama said, "You didn't build it," when he uttered that phrase to make the obvious point that all of these companies accrued all of their wealth on the back of public investments that go back generations. Yeah, no, he reaped the whirlwind from the business community for having said that.
And of course, they were very disappointed that Joe Biden didn't invite Elon Musk to a summit at the White House. Right. That's a terrible thing for him to have done.
Yeah, yeah. All right, back to your list. Dehumanization.
So this is something we saw from the start. It became significantly worse over the course of the 2024 campaign and then on into the presidency. Something fascists do, which again is 100% incompatible with liberal democracy and that phrase that we all know, all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. So liberalism rests on the idea that no one is worthless. No one is a brute or an animal or a criminal who deserves no consideration and can be flushed down the toilet. Trump has never believed that, but he started calling, for example, undocumented immigrants vermin, who were poisoning the blood of the country. We saw that in the 2024 campaign. Those, again, are terms that are straight out of 1930s fascism and completely incompatible with modern liberalism. And then what really got my attention again, we can thank our friend Stephen Miller for this, is out of all times at the memorial service for Charlie Kirk, where Erica Kirk, the widow, gives this astonishing statement of Christian forgiveness. Trump says, in contrast, "I hate my opponents." And Stephen Miller says, "You are nothing." He delivers a rant in which he says that his political adversaries in the U.S., the left, broad, however defined, "You are nothing." And I'll paraphrase, but the quote is easy to get. And he promises to essentially drive them out of the country.
Yeah, I think, didn't they also say, "You are wickedness"?
"You are nothing, you are wickedness." Yeah. The quotes in my article, it's easy to find.
"You have no idea what you unleashed." I mean, he's just basically, "We're going to destroy," talking about half the country. I mean, this is something that Trump himself has done too. Talking about your political opponents, again, not as, this falls right in the center of the definition of fascism, not as political opponents, but as enemies to be destroyed.
Yeah, so we need to come to Carl Schmitt, because to me, that's one of the most important items on the list. But yes, related to that is the way they talk about, and the way he talks about their political enemies, is as the worst kind of subhuman criminals and deserving of no consideration or rights. The worst of the worst is a phrase they just use constantly. If I had a dollar for every time they called someone the worst of the worst, I'd be a very wealthy man. And that's inconsistent with liberal democracy and our constitutional order. I should also point out, in the department of where's the outrage, it's fundamentally inconsistent with the teachings of Jesus Christ and with the morality of Christianity, which a lot of the people seem to believe they're upholding when they engage in this rhetoric.
Yeah, well, Erica Kirk is doing more than her fair share on that front, but yeah, the rest of that memorial was astonishing for the expression of just cultic Christian nationalist triumphalism without a shred of the actual teachings of Christ. It was quite amazing. We might have covered this a little bit already, but police state tactics.
Yeah, big one. This really turned my head. I think it probably turned a lot of people's heads, maybe yours. One of the things that did not happen in Trump's first term is, you know, he tried to suborn the Justice Department and the FBI, and he couldn't do it. There was too much internal resistance. Now he has. But beyond that, it's become apparent over the last few weeks in Minneapolis and elsewhere that he has created what amounts to a national paramilitary police force that is accountable to him, that this national paramilitary police force has roving jurisdiction over the entire country, all its internal portions. We're seeing, you know, Customs and Border Patrol is showing up in Minneapolis and dragging people from cars and shooting them. They're being told that they have an unconditional remit to do what they want to do, to defend, protect themselves. They're being told that the people they're up against are often Antifa and terrorists who are trying to kill them. They're wearing masks. They are appearing and disappearing without warrants, on and on and on. Now, as hopefully viewers of this show know very well, policing is a state and local, primarily local authority in the US, and that's very important. That's the way it was set up to avoid precisely this kind of state policing action that's accountable directly to a president. But now we have it. It's got an immense budget, more than doubled in size. We're talking about a budget that's bigger than all but 15 of the military budgets in the world. It's growing to the point where experts say that most Americans will have to have contact with it. This will no longer be something that happens to, you know, Jose, the undocumented gardener that you hear about from your, you know, sister-in-law. This will affect millions and millions of Americans, and that's clearly the point. The orders that these folks received, at least until recently, was display violence, display impunity, make a point of that. And I don't really think they're going to recalibrate that in a very serious way. So this is really new, Sam, and this augurs very poorly. And what do you do with this bureaucracy after Trump leaves the scene? What do you do with all these people who've been trained into this culture? This could be with us for quite a while.
Yeah, so this brings up something that I thought to ask you more toward the end, but I'll ask it here because the implications are quite obvious on this point. I don't think I'm alone in worrying about this, but I've begun to worry about what the recovery procedure from this will look like. I mean, just imagine in 2028, we get the perfect Democrat who just wants to clean up the mess his predecessor made. And I mean, just imagine that the as ethical and as wise and as prudent a person as we could possibly hope for. I mean, I don't imagine we'll get even half of what is ideal here. But let's imagine the perfect president who just wants to rein in the swollen powers of the executive branch and reestablish our democracy in good standing with, you know, all of our former allies and just press a hard reset here. It seems to me that everything that person is going to have to do, like cleaning house in the Justice Department, all of these Trumpian, you know, MAGA employees who work in the Justice Department, the FBI, now this enormous secret police force that needs to be disbanded. All of these efforts are going to look like, or will be spun as from the right, just more rank political partisan behavior, right? Like, okay, now you're going to tell me you're going to fire the people in the FBI now, just like Trump did. This is totally illegitimate. This is just more, you know, hyper-partisan, you know, malignancy in our political culture, even when it could be perfectly well-intentioned and the only sane response to having had our government so distorted by what is in fact a personality cult. How do you envision the cleanup procedure in the best possible case and how it will be perceived by half the country that still thinks MAGA was a good thing?
Well, I should mention in passing that they're already using all the devices you mentioned and that, for example, the efforts to prosecute Comey and Letitia James and others are being justified on the grounds that supposedly Biden politicized the Justice Department to send Jack Smith to indict Donald Trump. So they're already playing that game and they're very good at it. Sam, I don't have an answer to that question. I don't have a vision of how we get out of this and how much we get out of it. On the one hand, I don't think there's a hard reset. That just doesn't seem plausible. Something we now know is that about half of Republicans, not all of them, but about half of Republicans, there's a new study from More in Common, which talks about this, are MAGA people. They're not unhappy with what they're seeing, or at best, they're kind of minimally disquieted, but find ways to justify it. So those people are going to be around. So now we know there's a market for an American style of fascism. And second, we've proof tested all of these techniques. You know,
There's another way to interpret that poll result, though. I mean, I don't know how plausible it is, but I'll just flag it and get you to react. I mean, it could be that all the people who are signing off or appear to be signing off on everything the president and his enablers are currently doing are signing. I mean, they see it the way you and I see it. They're following what's happening in Minneapolis. They know about, you know, how chaotic and intrusive these deportations have been. And they love all of it. But it's also possible that many or even most of these people are totally checked out and not paying attention, really. And they just think, and they're just not thinking much of it. But when you ask them, you know, do you approve of what the president is doing to get these immigrant criminals out of our country? They say, of course.
Well, it's some of all of those things. And the great virtue of this new work from More in Common, maybe it should go in the show notes, mm-hmm. is it did a very large representative sample of Trump voters, you know, properly weighted and divided them up into those very categories. One is the hardcore MAGA. The second category are anti-woke, anti-left people who are capable of justifying almost anything Trump does because the left is worse. You know those people. A third category is kind of traditional Republicans, and they're much more uneasy about what they're seeing, but they're not willing to jump off the vote. And then there's a fourth category, which is people who are reluctant Republicans. And they voted for Trump in 2024, but a lot of them are having second thoughts. And that's the group now which is tilting against him and driving his popularity down. But so the point is, you know, whatever the specific numbers are, I think it's now beyond dispute that there is a significant fraction of Americans who are concentrated in the Republican Party, who like what they're seeing, or at least like major elements of what they're seeing. And those people are a significant number who will be around and who will have a political base. There will be politicians pandering to that. There will be primary campaigns, which will hang on how many of these Trumpian characteristics can you brag about. And that doesn't mean that MAGA wins in the long term, but it does mean we have to contend with them in the long term. I think a lot depends on one, what the electorate says. If there's a tsunami-sized wipeout of the Republicans in 2026, or heaven hear me on this, 2028, a real repudiation, that's very different from elections that are close, which they will claim were stolen. So that's one thing that's very different. And the performance of our institutions and the people on the street will matter. I think what we saw in Minneapolis mattered a great deal. I think it showed aspiring fascists or authoritarians that this will not be as easy for them as they might have hoped. And that's also very important. So I don't know how these factors come out. I just know I don't think we'll become a fascist country. Trump simply does not have enough control of enough of the organs of the state and civil society to do that. I do think it will be a country with a long-term, significant fascist element. And that element will be baked into one of our political parties.
Mm. All right. Your next category is all too relevant, given what you just said, undermining elections.
Yeah, this one's so obvious. I felt obliged to put it in. You know, fascism 101, always claim to win the election, try to steal the election if you have to, or just overturn the election altogether. And of course, we've seen that behavior from Trump and his followers, and we're seeing it again now. We're seeing, of course, Trump is saying he should have confiscated the voting machines, and he's quote unquote joking about not having an election in 2026. And that's really a dog whistle to his followers that the so-called election will be just that. It won't be a real election. It'll be a rigged election. And we're seeing the Justice Department get itself involved where it has no business being and going after voter rolls. And we're hearing about threats of use of criminal prosecution against state and local election officials. And this is, it's fascism 101. This is called tilting the playing field to make it difficult for the opponents to win. We saw this done very successfully in Hungary. We might see the opposition win in Hungary, which would surprise and delight me. But they're trying the same playbook, and we know how this playbook looks, and we know it's incompatible with liberal democracy, but very compatible with fascism.
Are there reasons to be confident that they can't actually accomplish much on that front, given the nature of our federalism and given that there are, I don't know how many counties that effectively are responsible for their own part of the election? Probably some thousands
of counties. On that score, I can only tell you what other experts say, because I am not one of them.
Mm.
The people who know about this say that they are unlikely to be able to throw or steal the 2026 election. They haven't had enough time. There's been a lot of preparation by civil society groups. They are ready with armies of lawyers, and they have, you know, a press of a button on their computer, and they can send a legal complaint. They're ready, so there's that. And I also don't think, I may be a minority on this, Sam, I don't really think from MAGA's point of view, the 2026 elections are all that important. I don't really think it'll be worth their while to do anything radical. I think they'll make a fuss if the election's at all close. They'll claim that the Democrats didn't really win, and they'll tell Johnson he has to remain speaker and not seat these people and try to get them, slow it all down in court. But Trump is not someone who's very interested in operating through conventional channels. He really only passed one significant bill that he cares about. He hasn't really sent anything else up to the Hill. He's interested in circumventing Congress. This goes back to his patrimonialism and of course, fascism. And so I think they kind of figure Congress can be Congress, and it can make a bunch of sheep-like noises, and it can demand that they go up to the Hill and testify, which they probably won't do. And it can demand that they release documents, which they won't release. And they'll succeed in showing how weak Congress is. So I'm really more focused on 2028. And there, based on what we saw in 2020, I have a lot of confidence in saying that Trump and the MAGA movement will not voluntarily relinquish power, relinquish the White House to the Democrats. They are too exposed to legal jeopardy. There are too many rocks for too many of them that would be overturned, even with Trump's pardon power. And they love wielding power. So I don't say that they'll succeed in retaining power if they lose a fair count in 2028. But I believe that they will try, as they did in 2020, to resist turning over power, and they'll be far better organized and more effective than they were in 2020.
But so are you imagining that somehow Trump runs for a third term, or you're imagining a J.D. Vance campaign where he loses, but basically a la 2020 insists that he won?
The latter, doesn't have to be Vance, but where the Republican Party refuses to concede that it lost.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever the candidate is gets behind that narrative.
What's private is public.
This is something Mussolini said that became part of the fascist template, which is nothing outside the state, kind of resembles communism in that way. So at the heart of liberalism, liberal democracy, is the idea that there's a public sector and the government, different levels of government lead there, but there's also a private sector, and that the government, except in special circumstances, you know, through court orders and the like, doesn't have authority to operate there. So it can't walk in and say, nice corporation you've got there, pity if something happened to it, why don't you give me a 10% share? Or why don't you bring me, you know, a gold bar? Is that what Tim Cook brought him? Can't remember if that was Tim Cook or the Swiss.
That was Tim Cook and the Swiss.
Oh, they both did it.
Tim Cook brought him some crappy sculpture that had a solid gold base. The Swiss brought him a kilogram of pure gold inscribed with something fawning and a special Rolex clock so as to mollify him and get those, I think, 39% tariffs removed.
That's lovely. That's such a sweet gesture.
Yeah.
From the heart. Yeah. So Trump never really has seemed to accept the idea that there are fundamental limits on state power. But in the second term, we've seen that he feels liberated to roll up to a corporation and say, okay, you want to sell those chips, make a lot of money in China, you can do that, but we're taking a cut. Or you want steel protection, I can't remember what he offered, but we're getting a golden share.
Mm.
We see him commandeering universities, saying, nice federal grants you got there, nice medical school you got. How would you like to let me run your universities and tell you what can be on the syllabus and who you can hire? Law firms, same thing. So this, I am not saying this is of anything like the scale that you see in a 1930s European all-out fascist society, but we are seeing what I think were lines crossed that I can't think of parallels in American history for this kind of flagrant violation of the public-private distinction, and Trump saying, well, you know, it all belongs to me one way or the other, so you're going to have to deal with me.
Yeah, and his suing of the federal government on his own behalf is interesting. I mean, now he's asking for $10 billion in restitution from the IRS for his tax records having been leaked.
Yeah, if you were the IRS, would you give it to him?
Well,
I think I would.
Given that he is the IRS,
he
can give it to himself, one presumes.
Yeah, he's working both sides of the table there. It's a good scam.
A tax on the news media.
So this one's old, but again, this is one that you have to recontextualize because he's taken it to new heights. So in the first term, one of the first things he did, I think it was February 2017, is he announced that the news media, mainstream news media, were the enemy of the American people. And that is a phrase that is very familiar from fascism in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't do much about it except demonize the press. And he called on people in rallies to, you know, he said things like, you can punch a reporter and I would support that. But there wasn't a lot of violence against media. In the second term, we've seen him act in a whole bunch of ways, right out of the Viktor Orban playbook. Hungary is a small country with a small media establishment, and Orban, who's the prime minister, who got in he was elected, I think, 12 years ago, maybe? And then proceeded to begin stripping the country of its democratic characteristics. So he sued independent media for ruinous amounts, forcing them to settle. He manipulated—
But we should just remind people that two shocking and seemingly totally unnecessary capitulations that came in quick succession here were Disney, ABC News, and CBS coughing up, I think, $15 million in one case and $16 million in another in response to lawsuits that they almost certainly would have won.
You can take out the almost. These were just crazy lawsuits. I talked to a defamation lawyer who read the complaint in the ABC case, and he said it didn't even pass the laugh test. And if it weren't Donald Trump's name at the bottom of that document, it would have been thrown out of court. So there's the lawsuits, there's the weaponization, the use of regulation, you know, the FCC chairman saying, you know, you better get Kimmel off the air. You've got the manipulation of ownership. So Orban did that big time. He maneuvered so that his friends bought out TV and news stations. Trump's done a little of that. Fortunately, it's way too big of a country for him to do much of it. You have direct prosecution. You saw, after my article came out, you saw the FBI raid the home of a Washington Post journalist. That, that was something new. We had not seen that before. Technically, I think they can do that legally, but no one has. And then we saw the arrest, the charging of four journalists, I think it's four, including Don Lemon, for covering a news event inside a church. They claim that that was a form of illegal behavior. Now, this is, again, this is, as far as I know, without precedent. So they're using every tactic they can in the book to try to intimidate and dominate the media. I think they'll fail. I think they're being stupid because they ought to know that they'll fail, that this will backfire. I don't even think they can beat the New York Times. Nonetheless, they're doing it. And that tells you something about their mindset, about where they think they want to take the country.
Territorial and military aggression.
Yeah. One of the reasons that I forbore from using the F word in the first term was Trump seemed, if anything, to be a kind of America first isolationist. He wanted to stay out of foreign wars and entanglements. He wasn't terribly interested in using the military or threatening to use it. In some ways, you could argue he was less aggressive than Obama, and certainly less aggressive than George W. Bush.
And he sort of ran on that. I mean, many of his MAGA fans imagine him to be just fundamentally a non-interventionist. And this is, you know, there's no more regime change wars. Now we're running Venezuela, apparently.
Yeah. And this was, to me, maybe the single biggest disqualifier in my mind, because one thing that we associate with fascism is aggression. Aggressive words, aggressive actions, the desire for Lebensraum, which means attempting to expand your living space, which means take other countries' land, take their resources, make them do what you want them to do. And in this term, we've seen, I think, tell me if you think this is wrong, but a 180 on this. We've seen, now many American presidents have used force in foreign countries, and arguably some have done it extra legally. You know, we chased Pancho Villa all the way, all around Mexico and did Puerto Rico. But I don't remember a time when an administration overtly said, when a president said, we're using or threatening force and coercion because you have stuff that we want.
Yeah.
That's new. That's not the way liberal democracies are supposed to talk. And to our anti-colonialist friends who say that's always been the reality, I would argue it has not always been the reality. America always has held back from crossing that line of explicitly saying you can do it the easy way or you can do it the hard way.
Yeah, I mean, however misguided one might think the war in Iraq was, the claim that we went in there to steal their oil was always a calumny from the far left that really just did not map on to reality. But even at the time, Trump was saying that we should have stolen their oil. They had all that oil there and we should have taken it. And
yeah, if you're going to go in, you might as well take it.
And now with our adventure in Venezuela, I mean, as justifiable as you might think deposing and incarcerating Maduro might be, the rationale for it was explicitly not humanitarian, not philanthropic, not a matter of spreading democracy. It was just, we want the oil.
Yeah, it was kind of comical because Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, was out there saying, well, we have all these good reasons to do it. And then Trump goes out there and says, no, it's about the oil. We want the oil. Yeah. We're taking the oil. They're going to play ball and we'll have the oil.
Just incredible.
And, you know, Greenland, same deal.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to have fallen out of the news cycle. Do you think that's still a thing? Are we threatening Greenland?
I never took seriously, maybe this is dumb of me because he's astonished me so often, but I never thought he would use military force against Greenland. And I don't think the Europeans, the Danes thought he would either. Here, the line he crossed, though, was attempting to threaten it as a coercive tactic. He backed down once they, well, really, once the financial markets pushed back. But that's not, again, that's not the way Americans talk. You have stuff, we want stuff, we're going to take it, we're not ruling out military force, even against members of our own alliance.
Yeah.
That's no precedent for that, but I can think of certain precedents for that kind of behavior in the 1930s.
Yeah, I mean, what Trump has done is among many other awful things, he's announced to the world that we actually just despise our allies. I mean, we don't really even think we have allies, and our allies have been taking advantage of us, and now we're going to find ways to screw them because we're more powerful. And we sort of admire our enemies, right? We kind of, you know, we in our heart of hearts envy people like Putin and Xi Jinping, and we want to operate a little more like those guys. Again, just to leap forward to the aftermath of all of this, how does the perfect American president, with the dust settling behind him or her, reset all of these relationships and the free world's expectations of us? I mean, have we indelibly seared into the minds of every other democracy that America is always no more than 4 years away from betraying all of its stated principles and voiding all of its trade agreements, and we cannot be counted upon ever again the way we have been for 80 years to anchor the liberal world order? Or do you think there's some path back to what we would consider normal?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. My guess is that there's a path back toward something more ostensibly normal, something that looks more normal, something that goes back to the forms of alliance structures and civil diplomatic relations. But I think it's the matter of a generation to regain the trust that underlies that, don't you? I mean, would you trust Americans to be a reliable long-term partner after going through this?
It's hard to see how it gets secured. I mean, I'm imagining this is could be purely delusional on my part, but I'm imagining a Democratic president could come into office and say, if I do nothing other than clean up the mess that has been made by my predecessor and make sure this can't happen again, it will be a successful presidency. So now I'm going to figure out how to limit the powers of the executive so that our institutions are actually more resilient against a psychopath getting into the Oval Office and acting like a psychopath for 4 years, because we've shown we're capable of promoting such a person to the presidency. And so, maybe that's David French got on this podcast and was arguing that we need an amendment to the language that specifies the role of the executive in the Constitution. I mean, there's a crucial ambiguity in how that is spelled out, and the executive really needs to be said to be charged with implementing Congress's laws. But I don't know how it's done, if it can be done, but it seems we would need to be able to credibly make the case that no matter how idiotic half our country actually is, and no matter how much they might have a demonstrated appetite for a demagogue who voids all of our liberal values, we now have in place a different institutional order that will make it much harder for someone to do this again. Right. I mean, just the fact that Trump has been able to seize the tariff power from Congress without Congress doing anything about it, and then tariff all of, every member of our species in the last year.
Right. I don't like your face, so I'm doubling your tariffs, yeah. Switzerland.
I mean, we just have to figure out how to make that impossible. But again, I don't know that we can.
Well, there's so much to do. It'll be a mixed bag because I've said this a couple of times. I guess I should keep saying it because it's such an easy point to lose. The fact that we have a fascist leader and a fascist movement in control of the executive branch does not mean that we have a fascist state, a fascist government, or a fascist society. He does not control the courts, and it's becoming apparent that he won't be able to. He may be able to ignore and defy them to some extent. We'll find out. But he cannot take them over, as happened in Hungary. He cannot dominate the news media the way he wants to. It's simply too big. He can't get his hands around it. He's a lame duck. It's not clear how long he can continue to dominate the Republican Party. This is a big one. He cannot amend the Constitution, because the first thing these authoritarians do in these other countries is start fiddling with the Constitution to make it harder for the other side to win. And it's looking from Minnesota and elsewhere like he cannot dominate the American people. That's a very big deal. Now, he can dominate, as you've said, some corporate tycoons and others, but it looks like the public is not going to sit still for this. And for all those reasons, I think part of the lesson that Europeans and others will draw at the end of the day is that American institutions have some resilience, some built-in. Oh, I should have mentioned, he can't he can't dominate the state governments because they're all sovereign under the Constitution. There's some things that they just can do, including manage elections. So part of the lesson that I think we're learning is that even as his fascistic intentions become clearer, I think his maneuvering room to execute on those intentions is shrinking. And the biggest single factor there is his plummeting approval ratings. And as the approval ratings drops, his leverage over Republicans in Congress and in politics drops. They become less afraid of him. And that reduces his maneuvering room. So for all these reasons, I'm not sure how we come out of this in 3 years, Sam, but it's some kind of mixture of dreadful institutional damage and reputational damage, plus a certain amount of at least partially reassuring resilience. But I can't foresee how those two things play out. The only thing that I think I can hazard a guess to say is that a lot depends on whether the 2028 election is close. If it's another one of these cliffhanger elections in which we don't see a solid repudiation of everything that's going on right now, we're still in the soup. If it turns out to be the long hoped for public, you know, what is it they say? There's nothing like the kick of a mule to educate a person. Well, if it's the kick of the mule, then politically it becomes a lot easier, I think, to do a lot of the things that are needed to recover.
Blood and soil nationalism. This is something that I was, I think, surprised by. I mean, this was always sort of in the offing, but it's become explicit in a way that is clearly fascistic. I mean, some of the direct communication from, as you say, on the actual, you know, social media channels of the government. I mean, some of the memes that are just, I mean, they're just purely. I mean, the one that I'm thinking of is, I think this is recruiting for ICE, or maybe it's from, I mean, I think it was the Department of Homeland Security on their channel, but it's the image of the cowboy riding the range with the stealth bomber going overhead. And I think the text is, "We'll have our home again," which is, I think, is actually a line from some, you know, white nationalist anthem. But even if it weren't, just this idea that we've lost our home, right? And we have to get it back for the real Americans, you know, now the so-called heritage Americans. I mean, this is just a complete repudiation of the idea of America.
Yeah, and what was the one, I can't quote it offhand, but they used a, was it our home, our country, our people, but they used a meme that seemed possibly deliberately, but clearly echoed one of the slogans that we saw in the Nazi days in Germany. Same type of thing. So yeah, they've gone there. That's been a bit of a surprise. I've never thought that Trump personally was a garden variety, Southern style bigoted racist, you know, who favored segregation and separate drinking fountains. It was clear from the beginning that he held people with brown skin and from so-called shithole countries in lower regard. But as you say, somewhat to my surprise, we've seen the emergence of a semi-coherent ideological defense of this idea, and coming from no less than the Vice President of the United States, who's taken to talking about a version of bloodline citizenship in which it should matter whether you, quote unquote, have been here
since
the days of the revolution.
How much does all this matter to his Indian wife? I mean, how do you explain?
I have no explanation.
Do you have a theory of mind for J.D. Vance? I mean, this is a guy who journeyed all the way from saying in his private communication that Trump is either a classic asshole like Nixon or America's Hitler, and now he's swallowed enough vomit to become the Vice President of the United States, and he's right next door to Stephen Miller in his blood and soil notion of nationalism, and yet he's married to an Indian woman and is castigated by the white supremacists in the party for having mixed race children. What's it like for him to look in the mirror every morning?
I can't imagine, except to say that it just goes to show that purely Vulcan rationalistic people probably don't exist. I still remember seeing J.D. Vance when he came and did his book talk at the Brookings Institution where I work. And he was, you know, it was one of those staged interviews with the two armchairs, and he's talking about the Hillbilly Elegy book. And he was the very picture of a respectable, smart, empathetic, small L liberal-minded person. Nothing like what we see today. And no, I can't explain that. I think you have to go into psychology to explain that and into the things that people have to do with their minds to rationalize what they see themselves doing. And Jonathan Haidt, you know, talks about the irrational mind as the elephant, which we only pretend to steer. But I don't know. I don't know. You tell me. All I can say is that in the second term, kind of out of nowhere, but not really, because a lot of it's coming out of, you know, these groypers and these people, you know, online who are talking about heritage Americans. But suddenly they kind of engulf these theories of bloodline citizenship for no apparent reason. It's not going to help them politically. It's going to drive away a lot of the voters that they need, you know, the Hispanics in Arizona and Texas and whatnot. And you have to figure at some point they're looking at these far right-wing ideologies and they just like it. They just agree with it. They just think it's right. I don't know where else to go.
This brings us to your next category, white and Christian nationalism. Again, this has been in the offing for as long as I've been alive. You know, the Republican Party has always had a problem with real theocrats and real anti-Semites, but they've been enough of a fringe where you think, okay, this problem is really, in some sense, behind us. And you know, if the Bill Buckleys of the world and others who may not be small L liberal in all the ways we would want, they're not amplifying and pandering to the concerns of actual fans of Hitler, right? And yet now the Republican Party can't figure out how not to bring Nick Fuentes into the fold. What do you make of this moment with respect to this variable?
Well, similar to what we were just talking about, maybe I should have combined white, Christian, and blood and soil as all really part of the same complex of neo-fascist features. But yeah, they are, I do not assert, as I said a moment ago, that these guys are old-fashioned Southern segregationists. And I certainly also don't assert that they partake of Nazi-style pseudoscientific racial hierarchy. What I do think is that it's become clear over the course of the second term that they are promoting a kind of vision of a country that was, at least in their imagining, a lot more white culturally and politically. Their DHS is running advertisements which are pretty explicit about getting our country back, and that's a message we're hearing from a lot of them. And then, of course, the Christian aspect, it's not Christian at all, but the use of Christian symbolism and the merger of the white evangelical base with the Republican Party and the MAGA movement, all bound up together. This by itself, it certainly doesn't make you a fascist to have a religious base or a religious support, and I would never claim otherwise. But this kind of merger of a certain type of authoritarian nationalism with a certain kind of white revanchism and with a certain type of Christian symbolism is very familiar to us. That is something that we saw in Hitler, Franco, I think Mussolini. Again, I'm not saying that these folks are just like those folks, but I am saying this is another element that ought to alert us that we're in a different territory than in the first term.
If Trump were to die or become incapacitated and we suddenly had President J.D. Vance, would you be more or less worried?
Do I have to answer that?
Yeah,
well, can the answer be yes?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. The truth is, I'm not quite sure I know how I think about that either, but do you have a strong feeling one way or the other?
I guess maybe I'd be less worried because Trump's demagogic talents are so unique, both in their nature and in his skill at deploying them. I'm not sure who else can do that. That said, you know, Trump is a disorganized guy. To the extent he's a fascist, he's, you know, it's a kind of temperament, but he's not, I think, systematic about it. We'll never see a tome of his writings that explains it. We haven't even seen a rational press conference explaining why he wants Greenland. He won't even tell us that, right? He just tells us he wants it. It's his appetite. J.D. Vance is a formidable intellect and a very organized person. So yeah, you could make a case that Trump brought in the crowds under the big tent and that Vance then is the guy who can systematize the whole thing. But I really don't know. I mean, what's your guess?
I guess I would, the thing that would comfort me is, which I think you just alluded to, is that Vance seems far less likely to be able to hold a personality cult together by force of his own personality. I don't think anyone in MAGA is going to form the same kind of cultic attachment to him that they have for Trump. But if he had a couple of years as president to work his wiles, you know, I think he is far more, I mean, again, I don't know how he became who he currently is now, but he certainly seems far more ideological and organized and committed to nefarious things that that link up with the ideologies of others. I mean, I imagine him in a room with Stephen Miller and Russell Vogt and the Heritage crew and, you know, people from the—
Bronze Age pervert and some of those people.
Claremont Institute. And I mean, you know, Michael Anton. It's like all, you know, you get the geniuses who think maybe what we need is something more like a monarchy. You know, the people who are listening to Curtis Yarvin, including Curtis Yarvin, it just, that becomes scary in a new way. I mean, it's not the the impulsiveness of evil Chauncey Gardner.
And how would you feel if in 2028, the person Republicans settle on is Tucker Carlson?
Yeah, that's also scary. Because there, I do think he's got some of the, you know, a lot of the charisma of a successful demagogue and the looseness of fit between his ethics and anything like real principles and real guardrails that I think he's a far more Trumpian character than most others I could think of who could be candidates, and also a lot smarter. I mean, I just think he is far more organized and far saner on some level, if not morally saner. I think he's just saner than Trump.
Yes, and love him or hate him, he's a very talented rhetorician who knows how to find buttons and push them. And he has shown recently such limits as he once had, and his willingness to push those buttons seems to have fallen by the wayside.
Is he someone you know? Do you have experience with him?
He's someone I knew. Like so many people, I first met him when we were both youngish journalists in Washington. I think he's about a decade younger. And then I knew him, and I knew people who worked for him at Daily Caller. And I think I know him. You've heard this from others, but it's really true. I know him as one of the most generous people that I've met in my time in Washington. He was someone who on one or two occasions crossed the street to help me out when he didn't have to share his time and his insight when I was trying to do a startup. The people I know who worked for him said he was a good boss and a decent person. They said he liked to, you know, he was the kind of guy who would like to, you know, hotwire a car and drive fast, that he did have that. But I saw nothing in him that looks like what I see in the media now. And I mean, we're flummoxed by J.D. Vance. I'm even more flummoxed by Tucker Carlson, except to say that unless human beings can fundamentally change to the core, there must be something somewhere alive in him that knows better.
Yeah. Yeah. He's, he's certainly an opportunist, and he certainly effectively followed gone with the changing grain of the media landscape and successfully pivoted again and found his niche, which is highly lucrative, right? I mean, so if you were going to interpret what he was doing based on following the money, I think you would maybe have all the explanation you need. I mean, he's like his movement from magazine journalism to cable television to, you know, I mean, I guess he got fired, so he was pushed. But I mean, just the unprincipled pivot to conspiracy theorizing about everything out here in Podcastistan, you know, it's very effective, and it's obviously more lucrative than being fair and balanced would have been for him. I think that is true.
That all sounds right. I don't know what goes on in his soul. I'm glad it's not my soul. I know that. And because I knew his prior iteration, I have a sense of heartbreak in his personal case that doesn't really apply to anyone else in that world.
Yeah, yeah. I'm reading that, it's not really a biography of him, but it's sort of a biography of him, Hated by All the Right People, that just came out. It definitely gives you some color on both his personal transformation and the transformation of the conservative landscape in America. So you have a few more categories here, which we haven't touched, and I'm now mindful of your time, but I wanted to come back to one person you mentioned wanting to talk about, which is Carl Schmitt, the thinking man's Nazi. This is not a name that most people will have in their heads, I think, but what should people know about Carl Schmitt?
There are two points at the bottom of my list here that really frame my thinking. I'll say the ones we're skipping past are pretty self-evident anyway. The leader aggrandizement, you know, his saying his mind is the only thing that can stop him. Hmm. The alternative facts, which is, you know, fascism 101, and that goes back to his first term. The mobs and street thugs, he hasn't needed them because he's, you know, he's got ICE, but we know they're in his repertoire. Because
I think some of the street thugs just joined ICE, right? I mean, I think ICE has got some Proud Boys in it, and
That's right. But we know that he's perfectly capable of doing that standard fascist move of creating street mobs, deputizing militias to, you know, do Kristallnacht type of things. He did that at the Capitol. Yeah. So the two that I saved for last go to a kind of theory of what fascism is all about. And one is the idea that's often credited to a guy who theorized it, who is an early 20th century German political theorist named Carl Schmitt, who weirdly, I think he lived into the 1980s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, at least 70s,
I don't know if he was a party member, but he's the person who provided the theoretical backbone for the fascist view of politics, which is, you know, in Madisonian liberalism, politics is a negotiation between citizens, and it's a way to share the country and work out conflicts and disagreements over time. And it can be ugly. Politics ain't beanball. But you're not there to dominate or destroy the other side. You're there to figure out how to share the country. Schmitt said, no, that's nonsense. That's for weaklings. The reality is politics is about contention between groups that not only fundamentally disagree with each other, they can't even properly understand each other. They can't even really have a rational conversation. And so that means that one side just has to win. It just has to defeat the other side. And by defeat, he doesn't mean until the next election. He means defeat forever. So your political opponent is your enemy. And this is something that we saw in Trump's mindset for quite a while. But again, now it's become explicit. We alluded to Stephen Miller saying that you are nothing. And we see the way Trump governs, which is to treat blue states, Democratic-led states, as enemy territory. Places to be conquered, to be divided. And we see in Trump's staff, people like Chris Rufo, who's talked about, you know, universities and I think setting them back a generation, that the idea here is they've only got 4 years and they've got to use those 4 years to make the left untenable in America. They won't tell us how they're going to forever get rid of the left, but they're going to try. And related to that, the other thing at the end of my list is their view of governing. In the sort of liberal Madisonian tradition, governing is built on you're not a revolutionary, you're working incrementally from the base that you've got, and you do that through rational deliberation. So yes, sometimes you need to do big changes, and that might be difficult, and sometimes you do have your New Deal, but you're always working through these mechanisms that build on the past. Fascism's very different. Mussolini tells us, fascism is not reactionary, it's revolutionary. It has that in common with communism, Bolshevism, as has often been pointed out. And the fascist style is to say, we don't need rational deliberation by bodies that are appointed by the public to do that. We need action, and we need rapid, impulsive action. And rationality is whatever we say it is today. That, again, is fundamentally antithetical to what it is that we think liberal governments are doing, but it's the way Trump is governing. We've alluded to some of this. He wakes up in the morning and he doesn't like the way the Swiss look, and so he doubles their tariff. He decides he doesn't want USAID to exist anymore. No policy process, just take it to the wood chipper. He won't tell us. There's no deliberative process behind going after Venezuela or Iceland. We didn't see, you know, an internal National Security Council debate where the thing was brought to the president and run through multiple agencies. None of that happened because the process is one of eternal revolution based on whatever's in the leader's mind that day. That's fundamental to fascism, that embrace of irrational action.
Yeah, you're right. Carl Schmitt made it to 1985. He was born in 1888 and lived to be 96. So you can make quite a mess in a century, it turns out. Yeah, and it's not a name that many people will have heard of, but you know, this is the kind of person that many people in Trump's orbit are reading and...
Or reinventing, yeah. Even if not reading.
But I mean, all these guys, I mean, again, you mentioned some of them, but like, I mean, there's a weird cast of characters around, if not right in the corridors of power, around, you know, coming in and out of those corridors now in America. And they are rethinking everything, including our commitment to democracy. And that has all been explicit if you've been listening to the chatter in recent years. Jonathan Rauch, thank you for your time and thank you for your brilliant work over there at the Atlantic. I read you with great profit and enjoyment, even when the topic is downright awful, as is our current topic.
Well, thank you for bearing with me and having me on the show.